I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538 or at www.umm.edu/Women's Center. We are joined for the first part of our program by Charles Blow, who is the visual op-ed columnist of the New York Times, talking about his column in the New York Times last week. Charles Blow, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really well.
Good.
Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or you can log on to Facebook and become a friend of Mark Steiner and put your comments there, and we'll read the dialogue and read what you have to say. 410-319-8888 is the direct line here. So many forms of media, I don't know which one to go to first. but your piece in this last Saturday's New York Times, Fired Up, Ready to Fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting to me. I mean, I wonder, your thesis basically is that when you write about Barack Obama talking to his mother and the piece you pulled out from Dreams from My Father, you said he recalled a scene. I'll just read it for our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I had given her a reassuring smile and patted her on the head and told her not to worry. I wouldn't do anything stupid," end quote. This was in part a tactic that he adopted to satisfy people, being a, quote, well-mannered young black man who didn't seem angry all the time, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that in some ways is the soul of how Barack Obama, our president, operates?
I think, too, in some degree. I think that you know, temperamentally, he has, for whatever reason, through his own experiences, in order to get along in some ways, or in order to fit in environments where he might otherwise feel uncomfortable, he's adopted a way of compensating for what other people see and believe about him, which is to kind of overcompensate intellectually, which is a great thing. A lot of people do that. I think I may even do that. You know,
right.
You try to be smarter than the rest of the kids, and I think that's what gives him a lot of his drive. You try to achieve, and I think that has played itself out well in his life, but it also means that you try not to ever be abrasive, that you try to be a conciliator, and I think, you know, my observation is, from what I've seen so far, I think that may play some role in how he deals with crises. I mean, during their campaign, they had this thing of no drama Obama. I mean, I think that he likes this idea of being able to calm his surroundings. That's great when you don't have to deal with people who on an everyday basis to get things done, who really see defeating you as the only way that they can claim a victory.
So do you think, I mean, when you write about Barack Obama as a mollifier,
mm-hmm.
as a hand patter, not a knuckle wrapper, as you put
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
And you raise the question, is that what we need right now?
Mm-hmm.
What does that portend for you? I mean, my assumption is, and I don't want to make too many assumptions, but
mm-hmm.
from your writing, that you may have voted for Barack Obama, that you supported in a larger sense what many people did when they voted for him. And I've said in public, even though many people don't in the press say these things, I did. Doesn't mean okay. We don't critique and push hard and ask a lot of very tough questions.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you'll never get me to say how I vote. But aside from that...
I just thought I would try. Go ahead.
But aside from that, I mean, I think, you know, his personality so fit what I think large swaths of the country were yearning for towards the end of the Bush years. You know, a calm, reassuring presence, a smart, kind of thoughtful person, an internationalist. He, all of these things that now make it hard for him were exactly what people were longing for then. And in the context of a campaign, you're basically regurgitating the same speech you know, five times a day for 12 months. You know, that you get very good at delivering that speech. People get good, they get good at rousing the crowds. They get good at, you know, giving you applause and feedback, and it becomes part of a concert tour. That's very different from governing. You know, governing is about bashing heads sometimes. Governing is about inspiring fear in your enemies sometimes. Governing is about how do I make sure you understand that this must get done the way that I have to get it done. Bush and Cheney knew that very well, and did that very well. What we have now is a country where people are kind of more politically divided, you know, probably as divided as any other time in the country other than the Civil War. And, you know, if you look at polling data, you know, polling doesn't go back that far. I mean, you go back to the 60s or so. But you don't see as big a divide, a bigger partisan divide, when people talk about, well, do they trust the other party and things like that. So at this point, when you have control of the White House, both houses of Congress, you have to flex a little political muscle, because that's not going to survive. That is ephemeral. That does not ever survive. Midterm elections come, those you see either big dents in those majorities or they vanish altogether, i.e. Clinton and the Republican Revolution, i.e. you know, Carter came into power with both houses of Congress, that vanished right away. I mean, it just doesn't last. And the fact that he is temperamentally so not of the mind to be heavy-handed means that this thing kind of falls apart. Healthcare kind of falls apart. And what we have to ask ourselves is that this is only one of the many things that have to get done. There is dealing with the wars. There is financial reform. And if you can't kind of sell this and pull this off and get, this is an issue that Democrats, you know, according to polls, care more about than anyone. And if you can't get Democrats in both houses of Congress that you control to vote for a cause that Democrats is near to Democrats' heart, then that becomes a problem. It's not the first time. Clinton couldn't do it either. But you have to start asking yourself, okay, is this president's temperament what we as a country need in the Oval Office at this time?
410-319-8888 is the number here. We get those calls that I just saw coming in. And Charles Blow is visual op-ed columnist for the New York Times. And see if you agree with his thesis. You can go to our website and see and connect to his latest op-ed piece, Fired Up, Ready to Fight. Or go to the New York Times and read it there yourself. 410-319-8888. But when you said earlier that people voted for, one of the reasons people voted for Barack Obama was because of this idea of having this calm leadership, a person who has civility. Mm-hmm. Was that an illusion for people? I mean, because that's who he is.
That's who he is.
But should we have an illusion that he was going to be some fighter coming out bare knuckled like Lyndon Baines Johnson and, you know, twist elbows and ears?
Well, what you have in a campaign is a very different thing. I mean, what you have a single, you know, once you whittle down the primary crowd, you have a single opponent. When you have the general election, you have a single opponent, and it is a bit more vicious. The handlers are telling you next day somebody says something today, you mention it tomorrow, and you say John McCain, you know, said the fundamentals of the economy are sound, and you really go for the jugular every day. It had more fight in it than I think he has in him personally. And when you're dealing with the Congress, it's a lot of people. And that's not, there is no one person. And it becomes a different kind of fight. And I think, you know, I think people thought that he was thoughtful, but steely. And I'm not sure that is completely the case.
So now if you think that, if you're positing the question that that President Barack Obama may not have the grit to do this, Well, I'm not going to ask you to be prescient about these. Let me move this in another direction first. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the things you wrote about was that he said that his opposition mm-hmm. And that they is angry and kind of going after the jugular, is what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the anger among his own supporters? I mean, you know, when you look at the polls, you look at the Rasmussen poll today that came out,
mm-hmm.
and his numbers are all of a sudden dropping again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can play the poll game all the time, but his numbers are dropping. So what about not just the anger of what people see as kind of a right-wing, angry, racist response that some people are labeling it that going on right mm-hmm. now, but this mm-hmm. other response that may be hidden going on from people who support Obama?
Well, I think that they find a genesis in the same issue, which is that his opponents are energized because they are making headway because he hasn't been able to rally his forces. And the people who supported him are angry because, for the same reason, he has not been able to gather the forces or the actual commitment to move on many of the things that he said that he would do on the campaign trail. And, you know, kind of the liberal agenda, the don't ask, don't tell, get us out of the wars, can you pass health care? And as people see that the president kind of is not picking their kind of fights first, they're disillusioned by that. When they see, you know, things like health care reform and the possibility that this could be passed with a mandate for everyone to have insurance, but not necessarily a way for them to pay for it in a way that would be affordable, i.e. the public option or something, some way of making it affordable, or, you know, kind of a deal with big pharma to fork over some money but also not be able to negotiate after that. I mean, it's kind of cutting into what people thought. You know, I think people thought that they were getting, you know, the smart guy who would actually be able to convince everyone he's smart, which is not going to happen. But also who was actually going to go in and make sure that kind of liberal issues were attacked right away. And that it does not happen that way.
And I wonder what you think is happening. There's always, someone said on the show yesterday, when we were talking about President Barack Obama and where things are in terms of race in America,
mm-hmm.
that we're constantly battling. I think it was actually the president of NAACP said this on the show yesterday, Mr. Justice,
mm-hmm.
that you're constantly in the battle for the, you know, ideologically for this middle that can go either way
mm-hmm.
in America. And that the latest polls show that President Obama has 40% of people strongly disapprove, 32% of the nation strongly approve of where he's going.
Mm-hmm.
And also in today's poll, you're seeing that all of a sudden now 52% of the people think that we don't need oppose more regulation of the U.S. financial system. All the things that Barack Obama was talking about seem to be leaning the other way all of a sudden now. Is that, from your perspective, lay at the doorstep from somebody who's not fighting hard enough and publicly enough for the things he wants?
Well, I mean, a lot of these issues have been hijacked. I mean, I think that the White House has just not played his hand well. I think that they've allowed I wrote in a column a couple weeks ago that the conservatives speak in bumper stickers, but the president speaks in thesis statements. You know, they're not quick enough to say things in simple language to help people understand. Many of his opponents are smart enough to do this, you know, death panel or kill ground. I mean, there's great little kind of phrases that kind of drive it home without you having to read 1,000 pages or without you having to pull out your dictionary every time the president speaks. And that's important for a lot of America, and that they're able to pass by a television and pick up what's going on without having to spend the time investing and studying. And I think that this idea that you have to, you know, kind of seize the debate on every issue that you care about to fight back immediately whenever you see something, which is a campaign tool, which they did during the campaign, but it took them forever to get involved in the healthcare debate. Forever. You know, it was months. So, I mean, in an active way, where the president himself was out talking about healthcare. And so I think that they either have to get smarter, they have to get faster, they have to, you know, kind of figure out how to seize the high ground on issues, to talk to people in plain language, and to seize the message, because once the well is poisoned, it's poison. You know, we can never talk about public option and not watch people's kind of frown and grimace, because it has now been attached to such a negative thing that no matter how many times you explain it as a positive, it won't go anywhere.
And I'm curious. This one line here. Then before we go, when you talk about President Obama's most strident opponents, and I think, let me see if I have this right, that, you know, you're describing how we live in a post-survivor America where the ill-intentioned form expedient alliances and vote for those who are too nice and will vote them off the island. So who are you talking about there?
Well, I'm saying that if you appear to be, and in this case, it's a reference to the president. If the appearance becomes, you know, that he is not a fighter, that he's not tough. And in fact, he may very well be tough. He may be very calculating president. He may be, you know, this may be part of his three-dimensional chess game that he's playing with everybody. I have no idea. The appearance, however, is a person who's not necessarily tough, who's not necessarily a bare-knuckle fighter. And those people don't win in this kind of America, in these politics. And we may wish that it was a nicer, more genteel process. We may wish that people played fair and the good guys always won, but that's the movies, and that's not D.C.
Charles Blow, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for always being as thought-provoking as you are.
All right. You're welcome.
Good to talk to you. Talk to you very soon again, I hope.
All right.
Thank you. Charles Blow's columns appear this month in the New York Times on Saturdays, and you can go to our website and connect with him right now and connect with what he has been writing. We're going to take a very short break and remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We're going to very brief break. When we return, we're going to learn about a very interesting theater piece being performed this weekend in Baltimore. You may not want to miss. Stay with us. We'll be right back for that before we look at expulsion in our public schools. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation with Caroline Reck, who's artistic director of the class Half Full Theater, that is doing a production in conjunction with the MFA program at the theater department at Towson University, our great theater department in this town, with a group called the Bald Mountain Band. They are doing something called Bunraku Puppetry, all mixed together, cultures convening to tell an American folktale. And Caroline, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. It's nice to be here.
And doing it at the Loft, which is just named Best in Baltimore by the city paper.
That's right.
And it's a more recent issue. And the name of the production is Fup Duck?
That's correct.
F-U-P, folks. Fup Duck. So tell us, what is Fup Duck?
What is Fup Duck? Well, it's a production that we've made by adapting a wonderful little novella by Jim Dodge that's just called Fup, F-U-P. And Fup is the name of a character in his novel that is a crazy little duck. And
on the cover of the novel, he's, in the story by Jim Dodge, the duck, looking a little mallard-like, is sitting on an elderly man's head.
Well, so that's that is our octogenarian, whose name is Jake.
Uh-huh.
He believes himself to be immortal because of a recipe that was handed to him by an old Indian one day, and he and this recipe is for homebrewed whiskey. So he's convinced he's found the secret to his immortality, and he's made it all the way up to 79 years when he suddenly receives custody of his little grandson named Tiny due to the unfortunate death of his mother. And so it's really the story about this old guy living out on his ranch and his young grandson that he adopts and their crazy pet duck, Fup. So we took this great little novel that did extremely well in Europe and it got a little bit passed by in the United States.
Okay, happens a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's a very witty and clever little story that I ran into because a German guy, when I was off in Europe, said, oh, this is my favorite American author. And I thought, who's this guy, Jim Dodge? I never read it. It's a short little novel. It's only 60 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a look at it, and it's one of those novels that when you read it, you just laugh out loud. And a lot of people who discover it end up reading it out loud to each other. It's that kind of a story. And I started thinking, you know, this is really in the line of American folk storytelling. That's what this story represents. And so we're looking for a way, okay, how are we going to produce this as a stage show? And talked to the author. He thought it was a great idea. And I proposed doing it as Bunraku puppetry.
Now, which is?
That is a Japanese style of puppetry in which the puppeteers, there are 2 to 3 puppeteers on each puppet, and they're manipulating the puppet directly. So it's not a string puppeteer. It's not a marionette. It's not a traditional hand puppet like you might see, you know, on Sesame Street or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is a more a direct manipulation style. And what we've done is kind of take apart Bunraku puppetry and Americanize it in the grand tradition of sort of taking a style, another cultural style, and changing it up and turning it into what we need it to be. So the puppeteers, rather than sticking on a flat stage, as is the traditional Bunraku style, are actually moving all around the stage. They're dressed in black. They're completely covered, but in such a way they're able to move around the stage in a three-dimensional sort of way. And then another part of Bunraku puppetry is that there's only one person doing all the voices and all the narration. We've maintained that, but rather than the Japanese style of sort of having the narrator off to the side of the stage and in a very formal way relaying the text, our narrator is sitting right up close to the audience in a nice comfy chair with a little rug under her feet, and she's just really relaying the story in sort of a folk storytelling tradition.
So the puppeteers are not speaking.
The puppeteers don't speak. It's just the narrator. She does all the voices for all the characters.
And that's interesting. So tell us about how the story goes. Tell us a little bit about this story, Fup and Fup Duck.
Well, you meet this old man early on. He gets the surprise of this little boy showing up in his household. And now Jake has had a rough and crazy life. You know, he's the kind of guy who was born in Kentucky, moved out about 40 years too late for the California gold rush, and made his living pretty much by playing cards, and stumbles upon some property to the north of in the northern part of California that he wins in a card game. And he's just been living this crazy bachelor life, married on and off, never really settled down until the sudden arrival of this little boy. And it's really about their life up there and this crazy duck that ends up living with them. She's quite a cantankerous character, and she sort of becomes the female presence of their bizarre little household. She does not.
The duck does not speak.
But she has quite a bit of personality. Now, she's not a Bunraku puppet. She's actually got a mechanism in her mouth, and she works a little bit differently. We ended up adding several different kinds of puppetry into the piece just to spice up the traditional Bunraku a little bit.
So, how long is this play? It's at the Loft, and how long does it last?
It's just over 1 hour long, and it's accompanied throughout by the music of the Bald Mountain Band.
And tell me about them.
They're a great, great little band that I met because they played over at the Unitarian Church in Towson. And they are
so they're local.
Yeah, they're a local band, and we started talking to them about playing along with this show. They're going to do a little few sets at the very beginning of the show just to get us in, and then they accompany throughout the show. They're a great group of, they're called the Bald Mountain Band, and it's a bit of a play on a certain lack of hair on the top of a few of their on the top of their heads.
We all get there. I haven't gotten there yet, thank God.
We used to call them the Bald Mountain Band and Jane. Jane is their one female member.
Jane's not bald.
Jane has a lovely head of hair.
So in this particular production, I mean, this is a production that can anybody, this is for an entire family?
We're calling it ages 12 to 112.
Good.
There's granddaddy has a bit of a potty mouth, I guess you could say.
My kids understand potty mouth.
Yeah, as I think a liberal parent who feels comfortable with just explaining a few new words to a child would probably find that this...
Well, the kids may explain them to you.
Yeah.
So give me a sense of the woman who's doing... Is it a woman who's doing the storytelling?
Yes. Temple Crocker is a local artist in Baltimore. And she'll sit with the audience, and she basically talks you through the story as it goes. She's saying all the lines for all the characters.
Does she go into character with different characters?
She does. Mm-hmm. So she switches between narrating the story to the audience directly and then goes into the different voices of the... There are four different human characters that she does the voices for. There is Granddaddy Jake. He's our 79 up to 99 years old character. Mm-hmm. There's Tiny, his grandson, who grows up to a full grown man and quite a big man, but maintains the nickname of Tiny. There is an old Indian man named Seven Moons Johnny, who's a shamanistic kind of character who's a friend with Granddaddy Jake.
Is he the one who gave Granddaddy Jake the power to live forever through his
whiskey? He's actually not. Two Indians in this story.
All right.
Amazingly, for a 60-page book, there's a lot that we've had to leave out in the effort of looking for the core and heart of the story. If you don't get a chance to come see the show, I highly recommend taking a look at the book FUP by Jim Dodge.
I want to read this
great
book,
little FUP. Great little piece. Yeah. And the final character is Tiny's mother, Gabriel. And she's a lovely little confused teenager who has a baby unexpectedly. And there's a couple more characters. There's Fup the Duck, and there's a wild boar named Lockjaw, who is the reincarnation of the Indian character Seven Moons Johnny.
This sounds like... Yeah. I love this already. So, and because it really just sounds like a soulful American story.
It absolutely is. It's one of those stories that you feel... I want to say heartwarming without the risk of it sounding like it might be a Christmas special. Do you know what I mean? It's wry and witty and clever, but it's really the kind of thing that makes you, you know, feel good about America and what that life is.
The story itself, FUP, takes place between 1880 and somewhere in the present.
That's right. Right when he published it, actually, it was 1980.
1980. So there's 100-year period.
Yeah.
And so this... It's about generations. It's about interaction between native culture and American rural culture.
Absolutely.
And how they interacted through the voice of these animals as well.
Yes, absolutely. There's the original story is really based on, you know, Jim sort of made up his own Indian animal fable with this story. There's a sense of how animals play a certain role in our lives in the sense of the old Indian fables, how an interaction with an animal actually increases your awareness of who you are as a human.
And it does.
Yeah,
and
it really does.
I love this. I'm looking forward to this. It takes place this next three nights, September 17th, September 18th, September 19th.
You got it.
At 8 p.m. at the Loft, the Load of Fun Theater at 120 West North Avenue. We can't tell you the cost because we get fined. Public Radio not allowed to do that. But we can say that it is cheaper than going to a movie.
And a better time. This is really a story about being in a room, sharing a story with a bunch of people live. That is the reason we're doing it in this form.
FUP Duck. F-U-P Duck. A book, FUP, by Jim Dodge. We've had in the studio with us Caroline Reck, Artistic Director of the Glass Half Full Theater. They're doing this in conjunction with the MFA program at the Theater Department at Towson University. The Bald Mountain Band will be playing September 17th, 18th, 19th. This is, we will be there. Join us there and join FUP Duck this weekend. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
I'm Mark Steiner, and I'll see you at the theater this weekend, I hope. But in a minute, we're going to talk about a very serious issue facing our Baltimore City School students and Baltimore City schools, which is the question of expulsion. Before we get there, I want to remind you to be sure to get your tickets for WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore. Thursday, October the 8th, from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the historic Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from the soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket price will benefit WEAA, so don't miss this boat. Tickets are available by calling 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628 or online at weaa.org for an evening of dancing, fun, games, and more. So do that. Right now, we're going to turn our attention to the question of expulsion in our schools. We'll be joined in studio by Jonathan Bryce, who's Executive Director of Student Support at the Baltimore City Public School System, and Janet Hart, who is Assistant Director of Advocacy for Children's Rights at Maryland Legal Aid. It is a hotly debated issue here in our school systems around the state. Will be hotly debated by our Baltimore City School Board. And we're going to talk about the essence of that and get your thoughts as well. But first, let's set this up for you. Melody Simmons, our reporter, has produced a story about this issue facing Baltimore. Listen to this, and we'll return to our discussion, or turn to our discussion, I should say.
Last year, after numerous fires were set in Baltimore City schools, including two small chemical explosions at Patterson High, school CEO Andreas Alonso instituted a zero-tolerance penalty of permanent expulsion. In all, 36 students, many preteens and teenagers, were booted out for good. But this fall, amid protests from attorneys at Baltimore's Legal Aid Bureau and questions about the legitimacy of the expulsions, the penalty is under review by the school board.
We're talking about students who make a mistake and suffering for that for the rest of their lives and having a fourth, fifth, sixth grade education.
Nicole Jassy, another legal aid attorney, helped to represent three of the expelled students who appealed. They won, and this fall returned to city classrooms. One of the cases was for a fire set with a pocket lighter, and the other two were for fire set with matches.
In most cases, it was a case of either trying to get out of school, but it was about peer pressure, too. We had two 13-year-olds. It was a bathroom trash can fire, and it was a kind of an issue of being dared and it was dropping a match in there. And I'm not minimizing the seriousness of that at all, and I understand that that could lead to a huge problem. But these were children who had no prior disciplinary incidences or record.
School CEO Andreas Alonso had a different perspective. In a meeting with reporters earlier this month, he had this to say about what prompted the expulsions.
At some point last year, I saw a practice, which was the growth in incidents of arson and incidents of explosives, detonation of explosives, at a certain time in the fall. And I learned that over time, this had been a huge problem in the district. As a matter of fact, I learned that at some point, like Walbrook was a problem. I learned that Merville had been a problem. I learned that even an elementary school, Moravia Park, at some point had been a problem.
Alonso outlined the danger involved in a school fire of any size.
If somebody sets a fire in a school, come on, folks. That person, regardless of their age, is trying to kill everybody else in the building. I mean, bottom line, I'm a practical person. A fire gets out of control, people can die. Secondly, it's almost a nihilistic act in terms of the educational process because, if there's an incident in a school where there's a fight, people take care of the fight and things continue to happen. It shouldn't happen, but, kids are kids. If you set a fire, it means that by law, we have to evacuate the building. If we evacuate the building, then bad things can happen. If we have to call a fire truck in, meaning that we take resources from the rest of the city where somebody might die because somebody was pulling a prank.
The CEO said the number of arson incidents declined significantly after the mid-October 2008 expulsion practice went into effect.
It makes sense, as in, kids know when you mean business.
But revisions to the zero-tolerance policy are now under review by the school board. The proposed changes would allow students under age 16 to return to their classrooms after spending a minimum 180 days in a city alternative school. Strict attendance and disciplinary codes would have to be followed, and the expelled student would have to attend a fire safety course. One father of a 15-year-old who was expelled last year after setting fire to a trash can in his middle school said the expulsion left his son shaken. The family requested to remain anonymous because the teen was reinstated in August and is trying to make a fresh start in the 10th grade at a new school.
He's remorseful. He's seen that what he have done, you know, was a bad choice. You know, as I said before, a lot of young people make bad choices. I mean, I know growing up, there's some choices that I made weren't right. You have to accept it and move on. I think he has accepted it. He wants to move on. You know, he wants to do well in school, you know, so he can graduate and do what's good for him.
I'm Melody Simmons, reporting in Baltimore for The Mark Steiner Show.
That was a report by our Melody Simmons. We're joined in studio now by Jonathan Bryce, Executive Director of Student Support at the Baltimore City Public School System, and Janet Hartshee, who is Assistant Director of Advocacy for Children's Rights at Maryland Legal Aid. Welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 or log on to Facebook and put your thoughts there. I'll be checking that as well. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. Are there some reasons why our students in public schools should be expelled and never allowed back in? Is part of the argument, and it's taking place now in our school system. And so let's talk about that. This we've had suspensions are down. There are 36 kids over the last year, if I understand correctly, who were expelled from our Baltimore City public school system.
Well, that's 36 were permanently.
Janet Hartshee, go ahead.
36 were permanently expelled after the permanent expulsion statement was issued by Dr. Alonzo, but the board has not adopted a permanent expulsion policy. There were five that had been permanently expelled prior to that. Now, we know of four who have been reinstated, three we represented, but we do know that, and none of those were over the age of 16. So we're talking about a 9-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 15-year-old, but for someone who's 12 years old, we're talking 6 years of punishment.
Can I ask you why they were expelled?
They involved fire setting in a trash can or nothing. They were not major explosions. They were fire in a trash can, and certainly they need to be punished. They need to have consequences for that. But should the consequences be 6 years and no education whatsoever?
So, Jonathan Bryce, welcome. Good to see you. Thank you so much for making time to be with us today. I know you had to move things around, so I respect your coming to the studio today. But Dr. Alonzo and I had this conversation months back, where he made very clear a statement on this show saying that some kids just shouldn't not be there. We cannot have this process going on. So talk a bit about the policy as it stands now and why 12-year-olds should or should not be expelled from our public school system.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having us on the program. And what we're doing on next Monday and Tuesday, first of all, on Monday we're having a joint Board of School Commissioners and PCAP forum to discuss.
PCAP is?
It's our Parent Community Advisory Board.
All right.
To discuss the revised discipline policy that is being proposed for city schools. And on Tuesday at our Board of School Commissioners meeting, we will have the first reader of our proposed policy. What we're attempting to do is take a look at our entire board policies and bring them in line with current practices. First and foremost, when you think about the issue of the code of conduct and how we help young people to learn positive norms of behavior for and ways to conduct themselves while in school, there is certainly a point where we get into a conversation about consequences, where young people's actions are such that it warrants some sort of out-of-school consequence. Now, in the last 2 years, City Schools has reduced the number of out-of-school suspensions by 5,600 incidents.
Mm-hmm.
We are very committed to having all students in school every single day. But at the same time, the CEO and now for the board to make a decision, we're very concerned about any student that would do something that would jeopardize the health and safety of the entire school community.
So, but the question, though, should some children, like the ones we just talked about here, who now have been kind of forced back in school because of the lawsuits they're brought by?
Well, we have, those cases, there was an appeal.
Appeal. And legal aid represented them.
Legal aid represented them, but what wasn't told was that there was a situation where they were told they were expelled, and then they're told later that they're permanently expelled, so they weren't initially told, and that they couldn't come back to an alternative school. And these are children who, under prior policy, would not have possibly faced expulsion if you looked at their record, if you looked at what had happened to them. So we had children without prior incidents and who were doing well in an alternative setting, then 3 months down the road being told, okay, now you're permanently expelled, and by the way, you're responsible parent for providing their education, and they cannot ever come back to Baltimore City Public Schools.
Well, first of all, I am not legally able to discuss the issues or the records of particular students. But in general, our code of conduct, which I've actually brought a copy, outlines the expectation for behavior for all of our students, and it clearly identifies that expulsion is an accepted consequence for certain behaviors.
But the question I have, though, is given the board met, it seems, at least from the conversation on the board of the school board, that a majority of school board members do not agree with a policy instituted by the school system on expulsion, and that they want students to have an alternative to remain in school. It seems the way that's where they're going. So what about that argument? Where are we going with the expulsion policy? What are you going to propose next week?
Well, first and foremost, I'm not able to engage in a conversation about what the board is thinking. The board had a workshop on August the 10th where we were able to present information and get feedback from them. Based on that feedback, we were able to revise our policy and the regulations to include those items that they seem to indicate.
So what's going to be the revision of the policy? I mean, if what are you going to propose that happens to a 12-year-old who may or not be an honor student, but who sets a fire in a trash can in a school? What's the policy?
So the proposed regulation is that any student found to have committed what we call a 501, a fire or an arson, if found guilty, first and foremost, we'll have an automatic appeal to the school board, to the Board of School Commissioners. So that's first and foremost. Second, after that appeal, if that appeal is not overturned and the student is found to have committed that offense, then they would be placed at an alternative school for 180 school days. And then there are three criteria that the individuals must meet while they're there.
Now, there's still some concern there in that the way it's stated as an automatic appeal is, does that exclude having a hearing before a hearing examiner? Which if right now you had an suspension or expulsion, you would have a hearing before a hearing examiner to determine a factual scenario.
Our appeals process has not changed. An automatic appeal to the Board of School Commissioners means just that, that the process that they currently have in place for hearing appeals will continue. So we haven't changed that.
But okay. Ed,
okay. Go ahead, Jim.
I mean, one of the things that's concerning, too, is considering a blanket 180 days, which is something that, and within the policy, that if they're not making the progress, then they'll be withdrawn from the school, which would still put them out and then not entitle them to their due process rights.
I mean, when we talk about students having to go to an alternative school, what does that mean? I mean, because a lot of schools like that, at least historically, are warehouses. So what does it mean to go to an alternative school?
Well, what it means in the Baltimore City schools is that we have taken a look at our alternative offerings. We revised them last summer so that our young people would walk into schools for the 08-09 school year that were focused on academic remediation, allowing students to earn additional credits so that they could...
But what does it mean for a kid who started a fire in a wastebasket?
Well, what it means specifically for that child is that in addition to the academic rigor that we've placed into those programs, they would also receive counseling based on their demonstrated needs. So if a student is found to have committed a fire, they go to a fire starter prevention program. If a student has a substance abuse program, they would go to a substance abuse counseling program in addition to behavior modification and a focus on getting them ready to return to a traditional comprehensive school.
And the concern is just a blanket approach, the withdrawing at the end. For instance, the cases involving that were appealed, they're back in school this year. So if you have a child who does an offense in November, is it fair to then look at the following November, or should they be judged on the progress they're making within that process? And if there's a decision they're not going to be allowed, they're going to be administratively withdrawn, then where is the due process right for that child? And then are we still having a permanent expulsion and just calling it something else, an administrative withdrawal?
Well,
without the right.
Well, first of all of the students that were permanently expelled that are 16 and younger at the time of the incident have been placed in some sort of educational program for the 09-10 school year. Second of all, giving students 180 days to go through a process where they are able to demonstrate through their behavior, through their attendance, that they want to be a member of the school community in good standing, I think is not only reasonable, I think it's to be expected for someone who does something that jeopardizes the health, safety, and welfare of school communities that have hundreds of students and teachers.
But I think we have to look at, I agree that there need to be consequences, but you need to look at the individualized student as you did in the past, which is to look at the history of their offenses, their record of attendance, and say, is this someone who made a mistake?
Well, that's never changed. We do not have a zero tolerance policy. What we have is a case by case review of every incident that occurs.
Well, but I thought that I remember Dr. Alonzo saying on this program that he has zero tolerance for anybody who starts any kind of fire.
Well, what we have is a clear understanding that this particular offense is unacceptable. It's not a zero tolerance policy. When a student is charged with this offense, that information is sent to the Office of Suspension Services, where a counselor reviews the information, brings the family in, has a conversation with them, and attempts to ascertain the facts. That information is then reviewed by the department head. After that, that information is then reviewed by the CEO or the CEO's designee.
Well, when one of the kids who was expelled is a young girl in middle school who was an honor student going to one of the better cities, except one of the better city high schools, started a fire in a wastebasket, I think is what she was accused of doing, she did. Is that, and she was expelled, should that child be expelled? Or is that some indication something's wrong with this kid who needs some help who's also a good student?
I actually think it's both. First and foremost, a student that in a school setting sets a fire, that is clearly a cry for help.
So is expulsion an answer for a cry for help?
Well, I think what expulsion does is expulsion, first and foremost, allows the school system to make sure that we have identified that particular individual and the seriousness of their offense. Because of the support that we're giving our young people by putting them in alternative placement for 180 days, we're able to give them the support that they need and hopefully to allow them to get themselves ready to return to the traditional school.
But what is the reason for the blanket 180 days?
Well, the blanket 180
days. And that's 180 school days. It's a school year.
It's a 180 days, and that actually is consistent with the Gun-Free Schools Act, which requires students, if they do something like bring a weapon, a handgun on school grounds, to be removed from school for 180 days. And that, we also believe that is a serious offense. And as a result, the proposal is for 180-day removal from the traditional setting.
with no consideration of the individual or their past or how they perform in your school.
All of those factors are taken into account throughout the process. And at every level, the student's prior history, grades, and what type of student they are is taken into account.
I do apologize for the shortness and brevity of this program today with this issue, because I think it's a critical issue. What we'd like to do, since I said we had the report coming out today and wanted to get this on the air, is to invite Jonathan Bryce, General Hartshee, and others back after you have your meeting, Wednesday, to see what comes out of this policy, and open it to all the citizens of the city to take part in this conversation, if that's okay with the both of you.
Yes.
I really do appreciate you both taking the time. General Hartshee from Legal Aid, Jonathan Bryce from our school system. It's great to have you both on the air with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with the learning issue, featuring reports on the future of high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations, and Urbanite radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 and bsomusic.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Producers Justin Levy, engineered by Brian Boone. Interns are the Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Christina Arison, and Richard Good. Theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.